the Veritex Community Bank Studios. ESPN 97.5 and 92.5 proudly present The Killer Bees.
Definitely a fan of The Killer Bees.
Now bringing you the fastest 3 hours in Houston sports radio, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
What up, H-Town? Hey, how we doing?
He's Joel, I'm Jeremy. It's a Monday edition of The Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5. Lots to get to today. My goodness. Have you recovered yet from Sunday Night Football?
Nope. I was telling Charlie on the crossover that win or lose at that point, sleeping's going to be tough. And then the soon-to-be two-year-old decided to wake up at 3 in the morning and not want to go back to bed. So working out about 2 hours sleep and about 8 shots of caffeine, but I'm here and happy to be here.
So what time did she wake up?
She woke up at 3.
Oh, no.
Got her to start fading about 4:30, 5 o'clock. At that point, I look at it and I go, yeah, no. Because if I go to sleep now, I'll probably sleep through an alarm and I won't get the girls to school. So 2 hours it was, but the most gratifying 2 hours probably I've had in quite some time with the results last night.
Man, yeah. What time were you able to unwind after the Packers' victory over the 49ers yesterday?
Well, you and Dell know you got basically a complete format by about an hour after game time because I'm wide awake and most of the sports news that we're going to cover has already been played by that point. So I was just like, well, I'll just go in the office and sit down and start hammering some stuff out and watch the post game and Sports Center. And by that point, I'm like looking at the clock. It's finally about 1 a.m. and I'm going, all right, so I'll hit the pillow at 1. And then unbeknownst to me, I'll be awakened by a baby at 3. And I'll be stuck to start Monday that way.
Well, at least you got a win. At least you were doing it in a victory lap as opposed to, you know, crying in your beer, so to speak. We'll dive into that game a lot further in great detail. Kind of nice to get the Texans out of the way on Thursday. I was telling you that it's so good that the Texans were playing on Thursday. You don't have to worry about them all weekend long. You can watch Ryder Cup. You can watch college football. And then, of course, Sunday, you can just watch the Red Zone channel, whatever game you want to watch. I wish the Texans played every Thursday.
I'll tell you this. The biggest thing to me was it was like overload. There was too much to watch. Like, I don't care how many TVs and how many options you have between all the NFL games, as you mentioned, the Ryder Cup, as you mentioned, the Astros, which we will get to, which need to be mentioned, but you got to stay up to speed on that and you're interested in that. But it was just a constant like flip, 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 flip.
Oh, I thought it was easy. Yeah, I thought it was easy, especially on Sunday because the Ryder Cup was already over. USA was
But still,
was
I wanted to see who was going to close it out. Yeah. I wanted to see, you know, because then you got to get the Rory tears and you got to get who closes it out. And then you got to get all of them drinking. And you know, and because it's in my home state, look, it was the greatest thing for me was, I mean, what a Wisconsin day yesterday in terms of being a proud Wisconsinite to say they called that the greatest venue that they've ever had a Ryder Cup on, and that meant something because that was completely made out of nothing. So that was cool. Brewers actually clinched the division. Packers win last night. If the Badgers actually had a team this year, it might have been even better for the weekend, but it was good.
Yeah, that was bizarre what happened on Saturday to your Badgers. I mean, they were winning going into the fourth quarter.
I told
and it all
you it
fell
was
apart.
Happen,
that was nuts to me, though. I mean, it was a game through three quarters. They were on their way to a victory, at least a close victory, or at least a close game. And then all of a sudden, boom, Notre Dame just scores like Will in the fourth quarter. That surprised me. Based on the first three quarters, it surprised me.
I didn't expect it to go that way, like be in it for three quarters and then have it happen. I just know that you can kill a college football program for several years if you make the wrong decision. And Paul Chryst, who's made a lot of good decisions at Wisconsin, made the wrong decision in letting Jack Cohn go and basically saying, we don't need you anymore after he had several good years there to where he would end up being the starting quarterback at Notre Dame and play gutsy, tough football for a guy because you were so enamored with getting your first 4.5, 5-star quarterback ever to commit to Wisconsin and finding out after you signed him and gave him the reins that he can't play dead. I mean, and then the signature of Wisconsin is have a strong offensive line and a good running game. They don't have that either. I think you're looking at that across football and saying, look, from an A&M perspective, and we've talked about how important the quarterback position is, they're finding it out yet again, even after trying to forget about the Kellen Mond era and getting into the first time that Jimbo gets his own quarterback, that if he gets hurt, and again, or if you make the wrong call on who to play, it could be devastating. And now we've got so much parity across all this college football, you ask yourself, is there a dominant team, let alone the 4 or 5 dominant teams we see every season? Because there's so much parity. You and I were talking about this last week. it's a real thing to just say it's a wide open, like anybody has a shot at this thing.
I think outside of the top two, right? Like I know Alabama played a close game against Florida, so maybe that's why they're not as dominating as normal. Georgia opened up as like 18-point favorites over Arkansas this weekend. So it kind of shows you that perhaps they at least have the talent to be one of those dominating teams.
Defensively, they certainly do.
But outside of those two teams, I mean, it's pretty much wide open. That Arkansas A&M game, not really a surprise. I kind of felt like Arkansas was going to win that game. I played that side of it as well. But it's nice that you have, you know, a new team, I guess, there in the SEC that's making some waves. And by the way, A&M, do they have some questions now? Like that Jimbo Fisher contract extension, maybe a little premature?
I thought that when they signed it, like, you don't have to be in a hurry. You've already overpaid this guy. Let it play out a little bit more before you go and jump to that conclusion. But no, they didn't do that. And then on top of that, you see what's going on, and you're like, oh, boy, man. I mean, to me, it's infuriating because living in this state, knowing what a football hotbed it is, the fact that you can get it right in every other position, and really both schools, Texas and Texas A&M, should basically be just like Alabama and saying, I'm going to take the three or four best quarterbacks in the area, and even if I let two or three of them go, I'm still going to have two that can play, that can get me where I need to go, and it's just year after year the same thing. You see the other guys that play all the other positions end up playing long careers in the NFL, and you look at the quarterback position going, why is this so hard?
Yeah, it doesn't make sense if you're, you know, a college football team and you don't have a good quarterback. I mean, it's tough for some of the other schools, but if you're a true blue blood and a power, you should be doing what you're saying. You're bringing in three or four guys a year, even with the 25 scholarship limit, which, by the way, is going up because why not? They want the powerhouses to stay the powerhouses. But a weird weekend of college football. It's been a weird year of college football, I think, so far to this point. Buffalo, by the way, how about them beating up on Washington? I had my eye on Buffalo because I've been a little hesitant on Josh Allen this year. I thought he got off to a real slow start. Well, he got back on track against what was supposed to be a very good defense. Maybe Washington's defense is not as good as we thought. And maybe the demise of Josh Allen's been greatly exaggerated. But keeping my eye on Buffalo and knowing that's the Texans' next opponent, not only does their offense look like it's back on track and high octane, but they have one of the best defenses in the NFL. They're going to Buffalo. They're going to be facing the Bills Mafia. This is going to be a long week, I think, for the Houston Texans.
It's opening at, what, 16.5?
Yeah.
It could go up. I mean, the thing is that, yeah, the demise of the Bills has been grossly overrated, and the real Josh Allen stood back up after probably getting too drunk on too many of the clippings for MVP. But that's just too good of a football team, and you knew that was going to be the case. Washington, I don't think anything's changed in terms of their defense, because I believe that Chase Young and company are really still very good. But when you play the best in the NFL, it just shows you the gap between the getting there good, the very good, and then the Super Bowl-ready teams. And Buffalo is a Super Bowl-ready team as opposed to a Washington team that's halfway there defensively. But Taylor Heinicke is still your quarterback. And no matter how much confidence he gets and how much he's willing to kind of run off at the mouth now like a starting quarterback, you got to play like it consistently every single week, and they're not there yet.
Astros get swept in Oakland. Mm. Not a great look. They're still fine. It was a 3-4 road trip. You know, they won the first three in Anaheim, then they lost the last game of that series, got swept by the A's. Good for the A's, by the way, getting 12,000 there into the Coliseum. That was their World Series. But the Astros, now they come back home. Only six games left in the season. They still don't have the division clinched. It's going to take a miracle for them not to win it. But any nerves at all about the Astros not finishing strong here over the final six, maybe missing the playoffs entirely?
See, I was going to say, from an Astros fan perspective, and this is normally what you do when you poll the listeners and get the pulse, I have no concerns they're going to win the division because of the fact that they created the pad that now they absolutely had to have when it was tight a few weeks ago, and they opened it up by winning 7 of 8. But at the same time, my bigger concern is we talk about peaking at the right time. Like, if I'm the Cardinals, I'm not riding my last wave of 16 in a row. I'm worried about peaking too soon before I even get there. From an Astros perspective, it's the exact opposite. I'm worried about a team that basically hasn't broached what it's like to like be clicking on all cylinders, no injuries, offense, defense, and pitching all at the same time. And I'm worried that they're going to come into the playoffs flat, which is the last thing a team without an ace can afford to do. You hope that that's not the case. You hope they get right at home. I have no concerns about them winning the division. But I'm starting to get a little leery of, like, when this team's going to actually pick it up and put it all together before the playoffs start.
It bothers me that it's not clinched. I'm not worried about it, but it does bother me that they didn't maybe win an extra game and the magic number was down to one and you only had to win one of these final six games no matter what Seattle had to do. I mean, I think it lives there in the back of your mind that it could possibly happen. Look, I mean, Houston sports battered fan syndrome. I mean, it probably lives there at some point that, you know, a little worried for the final six games left in the regular season. Look, this happens a lot of times in Major League Baseball. Whenever you have a long road trip, you kind of fade those last few games. You're ready to get home. Hopefully, from an Astros perspective, that's what's going on there. But not a great weekend there by the Bay.
And you called it. One of the things in their favor is probably going to be the Rays are going to have nothing to play for now because the Astros have fallen back. So they know they're going to be the one seed. There's nothing to play for. So the last thing they want to do is get anybody hurt, push any pitcher too far, maybe give their starters around the infield and outfield some rest. So they might be the best thing going for the Astros in terms of, one, they'll pull back a little bit, and two, it'll let the Astros start getting a little confidence again, feeling good about themselves before both teams enter the postseason. That's the ideal scenario. But, yeah, I mean, look, they were close games in Oakland. I really thought they should have won two of them. Of course, Dusty's going to Dusty in certain regards in some of those things. At the same time, it's very much clear-cut more so than ever before in terms of who should be on this playoff roster and who shouldn't. One of the guys we talked about in the past, though, that needs to be discussed is our man, Hey Siri. Because exactly what I talked about in terms of being ready for the biggest stage, the brightest lights, and the fact that the decisions you make and the way you play, one mistake could be the difference between advancing and going home. I got some issues with that guy that hits this weekend, man.
Round and third going to the plate. Are you talking about that one play specifically?
Yeah.
See, I don't put that on Siri.
Oh, I do.
I put that all on Omar Lopez.
No way. The way I looked at the replay, Lopez actually had him actually pulling up before he got three quarters of the way to third.
He was pulling up for sure.
And then when he rounded the base, he looked at it, and I think he thought he was going to pull a cutesy, and he was going to get a sleeping defense, catch him off guard, and get that run and be a hero in his dugout. Instead, it turned out to be the exact reverse. I don't care how many times I saw the replay. Nothing changed. I didn't hear any quotes post game. Maybe you did. But to me, the way that whole thing looked, no matter who they try and stick up for, that was on my man Siri.
Siri said he didn't see it. Did you see the dugout camera view?
I did.
Because the one where he's rounding third and it's right behind Lopez and right behind Siri.
Well, I saw the one kind of halfway down the line from third looking back. And you could see him.
Lopez is waving him at one point and then tries to put on the late break.
But he downshifted right past shortstop.
Oh, he was coasting first to third.
Yeah.
No doubt about it. He was coasting first to third. We'll talk about that in greater detail, too. I want to show you that the replay, too, from the dugout.
Okay.
Because it looked like Siri was looking away from Omar Lopez, which you can criticize him for doing that as well. Also, an NFL trade, a rare NFL trade. No, it was not Deshaun Watson. Carolina sending Darren Arnold in a third to Jacksonville for C.J. Henderson in a fifth. Remember, the Carolina Panthers losing J.C. Horn against the Texans on Thursday night. All right, 713-780-ESPN if you want to get in. 713-780-3776. We're on Twitch at twitch.tv/ESPN975. He's at Pac-Man Joel. I'm at Jeremy Branham on Twitter. Coming up next, Aaron Rodgers did it again. It's the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Get low when the whistle goes.
Real fun. Get low when the whistle goes. Sports. ESPN 97.5. Now back to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Jorquez to hold it. Crosby to try to win it. And the kick is good to win the game. The 49ers couldn't take enough time off the clock. At the end, all Aaron needed was 37 seconds.
Unbelievable finish last night on Sunday Night Football.
It's on my Twitter account. I need the Wayne Larrabee Packers. I know it's Jeremy's fault. It always is. But I'm just asking you as a special request. It's on my Twitter page. But the radio call from Wayne Larrabee, the voice of the Packers, as opposed to Al Michaels past his bedtime would be much appreciated.
Al Michaels, NBC on the call. 49ers needing just the, or the Packers rather, needing just the 37 seconds left to take the victory against San Francisco last night. Al Michaels kind of alluded that they scored too quickly. There's nothing you can do there if you're San Francisco, right? Like, you score when you score. I don't feel like they could have taken any more time off the clock.
No, like I said, you and I were talking during the break. There's a lot of people in San Francisco that were losing their mind last night because I follow some of their beat writers and people that I know. And then also, I actually just kind of was curious as to the reactions. People were crapping all over Jimmy G. Like, this is the reason why you can't put all wins and losses on a quarterback. He did absolutely everything he needed to do, aside from the one bad fumble where thankfully Terry McCauley was in the booth to verify the fact that you can't turn around backwards and throw it into the ground or look like you're and try and tell people you're throwing it into the ground because there's, first of all, no receivers. And second of all, a fumble's a fumble. But other than that, to blame Jimmy G for the fact that they're down to their third or fourth string running back and they're using a fullback as a halfback, but that he did not do anything to really cost them and he kept the ball moving. He put points on the board. He did a whole lot right. I think it's unfair, and I think that because Trey Lance was able to get one fourth down with 2 seconds to go in the half, which was a gutsy call, by the way, because if it doesn't work, you don't get any points at all out of the possession from Shanahan. But to think that Lance could have done any better, I think Niner fans are absolutely just stupid.
Jimmy G looks fine yesterday. He looked fine on that last series, which that play you alluded to, by the way, I thought that you had a case there that could have been intentional grounding. That was never called because
you're talking about the one on third down. Yeah,
never got back to the line. I mean, he got hit. But was he trying to throw to somebody? There wasn't a receiver in the area. It never got past the line of scrimmage.
The only thing you can't determine is because the arm was hit, what, you know, they're going to say, look, if he doesn't get his arm hit, you don't know where that arm is going to extend and where he's going to try and get it to. But just the way his arm path was going looked like it wasn't going anywhere near anybody but an offensive lineman. And that, as I was also monitoring throughout the game on Twitter, when you look at people from Wisconsin watching the game and Packer fans, they were all over that being grounding, and I just wasn't having it. I'm like, look, there's just too much of a bang-bang play where you can't, if that's what you're hanging your hat on. The thing to me is they were, like, questioning things where the Niners made bad decisions. They're like, you know what, you know, from an extra point here or whatever, like, there, the Niners should have done this, should have done that. No, the Packers went for it and skipped a field goal opportunity to go inside the 10 and didn't get any points out of it. If you just kick the field goal, and they always say take the points, if you just take the points inside the 10, you don't need to worry about all that.
I'm a big believer in making it an extra possession game. Like, if it's a one possession game, you should kick the, and it's like a 7-point lead, kick the field goal, make it a 2-possession game. Like, if it's a 3-point game, a field goal makes it a 6-point game, I'm fine going for it. So, like, whenever you can extend by a possession lead is whenever I feel like you should be aggressive or you should take the point, depending on the situation. I'm a little worried about San Francisco, by the way. Like, they barely hung on in week one against Detroit. Like, Detroit had the football after they were down by like 50 points with a chance to tie on that last series. They only scored 17 points against Philadelphia. Is Philadelphia's D any good? We'll find out tonight on Monday Night Football. And in the first half they played yesterday against Green Bay was pretty abysmal, too. Like, they're in a world of mess with what they have at running back right now. Mostert being out. Eli Mitchell did not play in yesterday's game. Trey Sermon, it's way too early in his career to really draw any conclusions, but it doesn't look like an electric back whatsoever. That offense has concerns that are far greater than Jimmy Garoppolo.
Yeah, and you know what? Like I said, and for the second straight year, they're injury-riddled. Their secondary is just absolutely ravaged. Now the guy you picked up, Josh Norman, has like two lung issues and something else in his chest where he's going to try and play again, but you know, this week, but he's all dinged up. They lost several defensive backs. They're, like I said, on their third or fourth string running back. For the second straight year, a team that basically has a roster that says it should compete with the best teams in football might be just too over decimated with injuries to be able to recover and recoup. Plus, they're still dealing with what to do at quarterback. The thing to me that impressed me the most was a Packer defense that looked like it was absolutely a sieve. Suddenly, against one of the top three play callers in football, looked like it was actually going to be effective, and it actually could do things necessary so that the Packers' offense could keep them in the game. That was shocking to me, because you said the one trade that happened today, Jamie Collins Sr., the former Patriots linebacker, is with the Lions. They are shopping him to whoever wants him, because they're going to just go young and just try and get rid of veterans. I'm like, it's rare to go in division, but if I'm the Packers, I'm calling going, what's it going to take to get Jamie Collins? Because to me, their whole front seven, whether Za'Darius Smith is out or not, their whole front seven looked to be completely out of anybody's league for the first 2 weeks, And yet, defensively, you can look at them and say there's hope.
Yeah, if I'm the Lions, I don't care if it's in division. You're 0-3. I don't think you're a playoff team. Here was the Green Bay Packer radio call on the win yesterday. Let's compare it to Al Michaels.
Listen for the dagger from Wayne Larrivee.
Hunter Bradley on the snap. Here it is. Placement made. Kick to the upright. And it is good! It is good! It is good! Nathan Crosby has done it again! 51-yard walk-off field goal to win it for the Packers.
Radio calls are always better than TV calls.
His signature is the dagger. Anytime the play that changes and ends the game for the Packers, Crosby with the dagger. Wayne Larrivee, who did Bears games, Bulls games, and has now been the longtime voice of the Packers, he's one of the best at what he does, man. And that oof, you saw it. I get the chicken skin. Him and Bob Uecker, and by the way, they celebrated 50 years of Bob Uecker being the voice of the Brewers this weekend.
That's so long.
What a good run.
I want to go 50 years as a voice of somebody. I better get started, right?
Well, the Skeeters have already made their intentions known.
Green Bay 2-1, 49ers now 2-1. The biggest game yesterday, I felt, Rams taking on Tampa Bay. This is something we talked about last week. We both felt the Rams would be a little bit more desperate to win this game, to make a statement early in the season against the defending champions. Well, they did. Rams beat the Bucs last night, or yesterday afternoon, 34-24. Matt Stafford, 4 touchdowns. Cooper Kupp's been unbelievable. He caught 2 touchdowns. DeSean Jackson had a big game as well for the Rams. And here is Sean McVay. He was very animated on the sideline, by the way. Very jacked up. And here he was talking about that.
I probably had too much caffeine from Joey Blake. He gave me some extra stuff. And I definitely wasn't short on energy. I'll probably catch cramps later today. But you know what? I don't know. I didn't really think about it. I was just kind of being in the moment and having fun and enjoying watching these guys do their thing. And there was a lot of reasons to be excited for our team today.
That was Sean McVay after the game. Rams looking good. Rams looking really good. Stafford seems to be just a totally good fit for McVay and that Rams offense. Brady threw for 432 yards, 55 times that he had to throw the football. But a big win for the Rams, and I think really show that they are a bona fide contender in the NFL.
Like we talked about, that's what I was expecting because that's what they had to do. Because otherwise, it was, like I said, everybody looks like they're playing for second. I said through 2 weeks of the NFL, the only team that really solidified themselves without question marks in terms of been there, done that, going to do it again as the Buccaneers. The Rams established themselves clearly in the same level of competition as the Buccaneers. They were a little bit more healthy, so they looked more talented. Gronk took one hell of a shot.
Yes,
the fact that
he came back
was crazy to me. But you have to ask yourself, one, is Antonio Brown in the lack of a running game fixable enough to say that they have as much talent as the Rams? Because just adding as an afterthought, DeSean Jackson, and the way he just separated himself on 2 big plays, to add to all the weapons the Rams have and now having a really good quarterback, means that in my mind, it is just, I'm not going to say based on just that game, but so far, the way the Rams are gelling and what they're doing leads me to believe they may be the team to beat in all of football.
I would agree with that, and I would say that these two teams are the best 2 teams in the NFC.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that fair to say?
I think that is.
Ahead of Green Bay, ahead of San Francisco, I think they're kind of that second tier in the NFC, capable of beating those teams that are above them. But to me, it's the Rams and Tampa Bay. Like, I know they play again this season in division.
It's just about being the most well-rounded.
No, they don't play in division. Yeah. I screwed that up.
No, it's the well-roundedness. We talked last week about when I said, look, when you bring all 22 starters back, you already know that you're pretty well-rounded on offense and defense, and their special teams is going to be what it is. When you look at the Rams and know, as good as they are with how many weapons they have on offense, the fact that the combination of Aaron Donald, Jalen Ramsey, and a bunch of above-average players around them means that might be the best defense in football.
Yeah,
to go with that offense and the high powered of that offense, they look like to be the cream of the crop right now.
I think that could be a rematch in the NFC Championship is where I was going with that. I could see them totally playing again in the NFC Championship game. All right, we'll take a quick break. When we come back, Astros 0 for Oakland. It's the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Hey, before we go to the break, I'm going to tell you that we're going to come back with more. Dell said, no, I'm going to come back when I need to come back. But the way I look at it is, if you had a tough weekend and you didn't have the energy you thought you wanted to have all weekend long, I've got news for you. There's a solution for it. They're called Apollo Men's Health. And you go to Apollo Men's Health because of the fact that Dr. O and his staff know what they're doing. They worked at other clinics. They did what they did there and realized some things work, some things don't. Some are a waste of time and a lot of you waste your money. They eliminated all that stuff. Doc O started his own clinics because he wants to do it the right way. So all he does is get you results and the products that work, and he takes all the other stuff out of the equation. That's why you go to Apollo Men's Health. For men and women, it starts with hormone therapy. They have the ability to get you the energy you thought you would never be able to get back again from your 20s and 30s. They can do it for you. All you got to do is be able to answer their questions and get on the right program. You want to get on a workout program? You want to recover quicker? They got all that covered for you, too, from a full body composition analysis to HGH peptide therapy to help your recovery. They are focused on you because your health is your wealth. You need to invest in yourself, and they can help you from the boardroom to the weight room to the bedroom. It's as simple as just getting in contact with them. ApolloMH.com. Book that first appointment. Find out most major insurance is accepted. Discounts for military personnel and first responders. Mention my name, Joel Blank. Get a free B12 shot on your first visit. But then take it seriously. Answer their tough questions honestly, and they're going to set you up with a program that gets you results. They've done it for me. They can do it for you, too. I love these people because they're all about getting you results. That's why I don't speak for anybody I don't believe in, and I certainly believe in these people because they're good people doing great things. It's the people at Apollo Men's Health.
Well, hello!
To call into the HRNP listener line, dial 713-780-ESPN.
Dial the phone.
Disappointed by your HR and payroll technology? Maybe you need to outsource your administration. Go to HRP.net to learn more. Now back to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Surrey runs again, and the ball is looped into right center for a hit. Surrey is digging for third. He'll take a look back. He's going to try to score. The throw to the plate is there, and he is out. So Surrey trying to score from first on a single. And he is fast, but Tony Kemp got it. He threw home, called out.
That was the A's TV crew on the out of Jose Siri there in the ninth inning. Some controversy, I seem like, on Astros Twitter. We've talked about it a little bit as well. Who draws blame on that play? By the way, it took a perfect play from Tony Kemp to get the out at the plate. The Astros challenged the call. I don't think they were challenging out safe. It looked like they were challenging blocking if the catcher plate. Was blocking the plate without the ball being in the air leading into the tag, which I thought that they might have had a case. You're never going to see it overturned. You're almost rarely ever going to see it called. By the letter of the law, maybe a case. You felt he had the corner of the plate as a path to get to, and I'm not going to die on that hill as well.
And I also don't think they're going to call that.
They're not.
Yeah, there's been so much nitpicking about blocking the plate that I think in that regard they're not going to have a game-changing play like that reversed when there was at least some white of the plate showing in front of his foot. So, you know, as you showed me the replay you were talking about in the last break, the one thing in my takeaway is that's, again, a hidden variable. We don't have verbals, and we don't have the audio on. We don't know, because Siri never looks back at him. Like, he gets the signal as he's already pulled the chute and eased up and downshifted right past the shortstop area between second and third. And then all of a sudden, after hitting the bag, he never looks at the third base coach again and looks at the play. And you know in the back of his mind, he knows he's fast and he's thinking, they're going to be asleep thinking there's no way I'm going. I'm going to catch them napping and I'm going to be a hero. And instead, he turned out to be the GOAT.
There's a lot of things to unpack on that play. 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. Look, with two outs, that's the go-ahead run there on the top of the ninth. I don't mind aggression in that spot, but I don't like stupidity. And I think it was stupid for him to try to score on a little routine base hit into right center field, going first to third. He even knew that he wasn't going to go to the plate once upon a time because, like you said, he started to slow it down right around halfway between second and third, just coasting into third base, which you could probably nitpick there, too. Why are you coasting into third base at all?
Well, I would have.
You know, you're a rookie. You know, bust it. Get to third base. You're not Bregman, right? You're not Bregman with a poor hammy. You're not Yordan Alvarez with poor knees. You're called up for your speed and your energy. Like, you know, bust it first to third. I can see that argument.
That's an Altuve-type heads-up play, but when Altuve does it, there's never a question if he downshifted.
Right.
Like, he'll hit the base full throttle and pull up once he gets a lay of the land looking over, you know, looking back out to where the ball is to make the determination for the final go. But I firmly believe, and I don't know where you sit on this, I believe if he doesn't pull the chute and downshift, if he just busts from first to third, I think he makes it.
I think it changes the dynamic of the play, though.
Mm-hmm.
Because him slowing down, I think, is why you saw the A's ease up a little bit with, like, the cutoff into Tony Kemp. Like, if he's busting it the whole way, I think they hustle the ball back into the infield.
They know it might be a play.
And him going is never really a question. I don't think Omar Lopez at that point waves him home. That's the other aspect to take of it. Yordan Alvarez is on deck. So you took an at-bat away from him with an opportunity to drive in the go-ahead run who would have been at third base. The Omar Lopez part of the equation is an angle of it as well. Like, what is Omar Lopez doing in that situation? Waving Siri, trying to catch the defense napping, which I thought also in the back of my mind, Gary Pettis is back on this team. Gary Pettis has not been coaching third ever since he's gotten back, and I'm not exactly sure the dynamic there. Like, I don't know if Dusty doesn't like Pettis coaching third because he's a little too aggressive, but whenever he came back, Dusty's like, no, he's not going to coach third.
It's not overexertion. All you do is between innings, you trot a little bit further instead of sitting on the dugout. You trot to the third base box.
There's no doubt in my mind that Dusty doesn't like his style at third. There's no doubt in my mind. Why else wouldn't he be out there?
Here's the other thing, though, Jeremy, when you think about this, right? Because you can make the judgment once you're already rounding third, but the nonverbal is whether you look and see he didn't see me or not. If you just start screaming, get your ass back to third, there's because the throw is going to go all the way through to the plate, he still, no matter how hard he was trying, he was thinking about going home, he could have pulled up halfway through and still gotten back to third without being an out. And that's why I wanted the audio we don't have. I'd like to hear the verbals of, because you knew as a third base coach, so you can see where his eyes are. You know his eyes are on the play. If there's nonverbals and there's verbals, if I could hear him yelling, I'd feel a whole lot better.
I believe Jose Siri whenever he said he never saw Omar Lopez put on the stop sign because he was coasting into third. Lopez did like a quick wave, and then you could see Siri kind of look up to the play, which another thing, why are you looking up at the play and not looking at your coach? Then he puts on the late stop sign. Siri never saw it, runs right through it. I tried really hard to look at every angle of this, and I looked at every angle of this. You can never see the right frame to see Omar Lopez like use that verbal. Right. So that's impossible to know with the frames that we've gotten, but it is something that you have to consider on that play. Also, nitpicky, I thought the slide by Jose Siri was really bad.
A bad slide.
I think you go head first, way outside of the catcher, towards the foul side of home plate, and then you whip around, try that little, the swipe
tag
on the
plate. We've seen your
boy
Correa do it multiple times. Yuli's even been able to do it, where if you use the Superman slide, and like you said, you get way outside of that batter's box area, and just swipe the corner of the plate with your fingers and with the mitt, the oven mitt you got on, you got a far better chance of beating that play because now the tag, which has to come quickly and sweep, is a good chance of missing you on the sweep, depending on from Yan Gomes' perspective, you're thinking about a body, a leg, a torso to be able to hit. When it's just fingers along the ground, there's a chance he misses you completely.
Yeah, I think a better slide gets him there, and I thought Tony Kemp made a great play. Like, if Tony Kemp doesn't make a perfect play there, we're talking about this play a lot differently today. The moral of the story, though, the Astros get swept out of Oakland. The magic number stays at 2 with 6 games to play. A couple of things from the series. One, Michael Brantley still not around. 6 games left in the regular season. The level of concern has to start rising if you're an Astros fan that wants to see Brantley.
He was up and about and active, and they expect him to be active on the homestand. I'm not going to panic on that one yet. Though,
but does the concern level rise a little bit the closer you get to the end of the regular season?
Well, but it shouldn't for me because when you and I had this conversation, I said, look, I don't expect to see him till the homestand. Now, if we start playing Tampa and he's not playing, now it's going to be ratcheted up for me.
If I don't see him Tuesday in the lineup, I'm going to be a little bit more worried, a lot more worried, to be honest with you. 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. And, of course, we got to talk about Odorizzi. Odorizzi, 4 innings, gives up a run on 4 hits, walks 2, shaky at best.
Yeah,
for Jake
Odorizzi. Didn't impress me. Look, in terms of the things where I was talking about guys that really need to take a look in the mirror while the organization looks at them for this playoff roster, Maton has just basically solidified the fact he has no business being on this playoff roster.
Couldn't agree more.
Yeah,
couldn't agree more about
he's
that.
He's absolutely out. Now, your boy Brooks Raley, because of the fact that Dusty's not going to let him not be on the roster.
Yep.
I just, him and or Taylor, it's a shame, but neither lefty does anything for me. One has more velo than the other has more control of his breaking pitches, but neither guy knocks my socks off to say righties, lefties, or otherwise. Neither one impressed me. And then you have to ask yourself the question for Odorizzi, for Todd Callis to be able to indicate he's not stretched out now because of the time he missed, and he really didn't miss all that much time. And in the time that he did give you 4 innings, look, he got lucky that he didn't get barreled up and they caught it on the end of the bat, or the one ball hit to the warning track could have been a 3-run bomb and really made him look bad. I don't know that I want that guy on the mound as a starter, relief pitcher, otherwise if I'm an Astros fan in the playoffs.
Won't start a game. I think he makes the playoff roster just because he's a veteran and the Astros are paying him a lot of money.
Don't you think the future really sits on that decision with Greinke? If Greinke comes back and looks like he could be Greinke again, then I think the chances are Odorizzi can get pushed away. If Greinke still looks shaky, I don't think you have any choice but to keep Odorizzi around.
I think they end up keeping both of them on the playoff roster. But, yeah, Greinke coming back and having trust in Greinke certainly minimizes the chances of Odorizzi making the playoff roster. Let's go to the HRMP listener line. Keith, you're in the Hive with the Killer Bees.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
What's up,
Keith? I want to talk about this young NFL coaches corner. I counted 8 teams that have young coaches, Stefanski, Shanahan, so forth, and who are just as fit as the players, good-looking, talented, and all that good stuff.
Keith, are you married?
Keith, are you trying to date them, or are you just trying to rate them?
No. And so my question is the McCarthy's of the NFL, they're I think the game is passing them by, and I think a coach like the Minnesota Gophers at the University of Minnesota is a prime candidate to join this club of youthful coaches that make the game exciting, and they're all playing chess. None of them are playing checkers. It's just making football really good to watch, and I just wanted to get your thoughts. Have a good one.
Thank you for listening, Keith. Appreciate the call. As Dell points out in our ears, Minnesota just lost to Bowling Green at home. I do like Row the Boat, though. I like P.J. Fleck, but you can't be losing at home, Jeremy, to Bowling Green and expect to be an NFL head coach. To Keith's point, look, I think that the young wave of NFL coaches is something that's been popular for the last 4, 5, 6 seasons now. I think it is the in vogue thing to do. I think the Texans do that whenever they're ready to be a winning team again.
Jeremy, what Keith is missing here in the variables that need to be mentioned when talking about strikingly handsome coaches in the NFL that are youthful in age, All the ones he's talking about have been raised with a career in the NFL. Shanahan, through his dad, through his, you know, being a assistant, you know, to a quality control until he worked his way up. Stefanski the same way. I've already warned you, and I pointed to Urban Meyer before the season started, before anybody had any kind of tape to be able to really say whether it was right or wrong. I said, college coaches translating to the NFL don't normally translate well, and it worries me, and I didn't think Urban was going to be good. I think that's why guys like Fleck aren't going to make the jump, because it means something to be able to convince and buy in your players on rowing the boat when they're not making more money than you, when they need you more than you need them. In the NFL, all those gimmicky things that work in college are going to be scoffed at by veterans that are making cake going, you know what, coach? I don't give a rat's ass what you think about what boat you're rowing. I'm worried about getting my check, doing as much as necessary to stay healthy, don't get dinged up, and playing on Sunday.
I think the best college coach would have a chance to do that is Lincoln Riley. I think Lincoln Riley's a better version of Cliff Kingsbury, and Cliff Kingsbury is in the NFL. You can argue to
Lincoln
what degree.
Riley going to try a 68-yard field goal?
No, he's not. That's why I said Lincoln Riley probably a little higher level than Cliff Kingsbury. Right. To Keith's credit, in defense of Keith, I don't think he meant specifically like a college coach coming up. Like, he just meant like the wave of young coaches in the NFL. But maybe it's a hotshot young OC.
But he said Fleck is the
guy.
Well,
I think he probably is familiar with Fleck more than he's familiar with like young offensive assistants around the NFL. I think Keith's point was more to the fact of like this young wave of coaches is the new generation and the way to go, and David Culley is not.
LaFleur's brother, who worked under Shanahan, who's the OC at the Jets. He's the kind of guy that would be fitting the mold of NFL-type guy that would be primed to take an NFL head coaching job.
I think that's what Keith was saying, and he just went to P.J. Fleck because it was the first one in his mind. All right, coming up next, is there any dominant team in college football this year? It's the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
You're listening to ESPN 97.5.
I don't blame it, Don.
Now back to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. A dominant team in college football. I think you start at the top of the AP. Look, Alabama's undefeated. They played the close game against Florida. That was in Gainesville. Georgia, the fact, not only the fact that they're 4-0, but the fact that they opened up as like 15, 16-point favorites for the 8th-ranked team in the country in Arkansas this weekend, I think it shows you that they're probably in that dominant conversation. Outside of them, though, is Oregon dominant? They won at Ohio State. How much you believe in Ohio State? Is Penn State, number 4 team in the country right now, dominant? Iowa, dominant? Oklahoma? Oklahoma's been struggling against West Virginia's
of the
world.
Spencer Rattler, who everybody was supposed to be tanking for in the NFL, to like lose his starting job. And I said this to you at the start of the year. They didn't look impressive to me. He didn't look impressive to me. And everybody's like, oh, it's a level of competition. When they start playing bigger games, he'll really start balling out. He hasn't. Oregon, they're not going to really play anybody too much that's going to test them, with the exception of maybe UCLA. So you look at that and go, at the end of the year, they're probably going to be there simply because of the fact that there's not going to be too much standing in their way. Penn State doesn't impress me. Iowa certainly doesn't impress me. I just think that there's more question marks and ifs, buts, candies, nuts than there is bona fide teams that can play. Clemson's almost, they're 2-2. They should be out of the top 25, but they're barely hanging on by a thread. Their offense looks ridiculous. And Georgia's only there because of their defense right now. Their offense looks like, you know, there's enough talent that they should be in the conversation. But the SEC schedule is going to dictate exactly who they are and who they're not. Alabama's the clear-cut cream of the crop again, but everybody else looks like they're playing with a legit chance to get into the top four.
Oklahoma might be the biggest frauds in the nation now. They're 4-0. They've only won one game more than by a double digits. They beat Tulane by 5. They beat Nebraska by 7, and they just beat West Virginia by 3. But, I mean, everybody else in that conversation, I mean, doesn't look great either. Like the teams that you mentioned, I think Arkansas, to me, Arkansas has made the best leap from the start of the season to where they are now. I mean, they were unranked. Now they're the 8th team in the country. They beat Texas A&M over the weekend, convincing fashion for Arkansas as well. I'm holding out hope for Cincinnati, but Cincinnati didn't look all that great against Indiana. They face a test this weekend in Notre Dame. Dell, of all the teams that you've seen, Dell does the 2-deep each and every weekend over on the network. Who do you think is dominant, first off? And then who are some teams kind of under the radar that you think that can crash the party in college football?
Well, I don't know if any team is dominant completely. I think Georgia has the most dominant unit in the game, and that's their defense. So if I was going to lean to a team that has a dominant part and a competent other part, that would be Georgia. And they'll see Florida a little bit later. They got Arkansas this week. As you mentioned, Alabama has Ole Miss. So we'll see if the, I won't call them lower tier, but that second tier of the SEC West is as good as they appear to be, because they're going to be facing the two best teams in the conference and maybe the two best teams in the nation. But I think Georgia's the top at the top of my list right now.
Yeah, Georgia looks really good for who they've played so far. Team under the radar, in your opinion, Dell, that's not getting as much love as they should right now.
See, that's an interesting question, because it depends on what you're asking about. Are you talking about the playoffs or just a team that's pretty good? I would say, because I think Georgia and Alabama are clearly the playoff contenders, and if they find a way to play each other twice, SEC title game and play in the playoff final, then that's probably our best bet for a great game. As far as under the radar,
is Oregon considered under the radar after beating Ohio State?
You can't be at that point.
Nah. They become noticeable, right? They become, and because of the lack of talent, like we talked about, in the top five that's normally rock solid, Oregon to me was a team that no one expected to be on the radar. But because of all of the disappointments, I think you can't say that they're under it, because that win solidified them.
Oregon is going to have what Clemson has had the last 5 or 6 years. I guess we get to them too. They have a clear path with not an immediate challenger, and it be disappointing if they don't close this out. UCLA is waiting there. UCLA bounced back from their loss to Fresno, who's a pretty good team, and beat Stanford, who had been a bit hot the last couple weeks. That's the challenge. Can you avoid what Pac-12 teams have been they've been unable to avoid? The cannibalism of the conference. There is not a team that should get in their way, but you have Anthony Brown at quarterback. Maybe you have a game where you don't run the ball very well. Their defense forced 5 turnovers against Arizona. I mean, it's weird to say, but Arizona, if they could hold onto the ball, that could have been a more competitive game, because I don't think Oregon played that well. Avoid the upset is what Oregon has to do the rest of the way.
Can I give you guys a sleeper? Not that I'm saying they're national title contenders, but if you say under the radar, and again, the schedule will dictate if they're pretenders or contenders. Lane Kiffin's Ole Miss squad can score points.
This weekend's a big weekend for them.
They got a legit quarterback. they can do a whole lot right. Now, can they do it defensively? Can they do it consistently through a really, really gauntlet tough schedule in the SEC? That remains to be seen. But if I was going to say one team that's really I paid attention to that could be considered under the radar legitimately would be Ole Miss.
And that's a team, too, that has the schedule to make the climb, right? Like, they're currently 12th in the nation. If they beat Alabama and Arkansas these next 2 weeks, I mean, they're going to be a top five team. I mean, they're going to be probably top three team in the country if you win those two games. It seems like every year there's a team that comes from out of nowhere in the SEC that probably goes like 10-2 and they're the next great. Like last year was A&M. A&M wins the New Year's Six game against North Carolina, and they come back this year. And look, they had a quarterback get hurt in Haynes King. I think they would look a lot different if Haynes King was their starter. But like if Corral goes in there and beats Alabama in Tuscaloosa, yeah, you have to take Ole Miss seriously.
Yeah. Well, look, there's something to be said about controlling your own destiny, right? It's not an easy destiny to control. But the fact that you're going to run the schedule right, and you don't have to try and hope for losses and hope that other teams get upset. It's going right through Main Street. You're going there, then they're coming here, and you're going to find out who you really are and where you really should be. But if you handle your business the next 2 weeks, like you said, there's the team that everybody's not going to have been even considered talking about in terms of a possible playoff team that's going to be right in the thick of things.
They're unranked coming into the Ole Miss.
Kind of like Arkansas.
Because, I mean, like you said, Jeremy, look.
And you get SEC love, too. Like, if you start off hot and you're from the SEC, even if you only beat one SEC team, you're going to get SEC love and be propelled to the top 15.
Just because of all the quirkiness, Leach is going to be a guy that they're going to look at, too, when you get new coaches in the conference.
Yep.
But you know what? It's shticky and gimmicky, and most of the times it's fool's gold. When you look at Lane Kiffin, and you know coming into the conference, one thing you knew he was going to be able to do was get the offense going. But that offense, they can have you worn out with how fast they play, too. And Alabama, as deep as they are, probably has the talent to go too deep and deal with it. Most schools don't. So that's a big factor.
And if Corral really is the best quarterback in the nation, I mean, quarterbacks can take you a long way. You can pull off an upset. We've seen Alabama when they struggle with quarterbacks, kind of guys that are dual threat. While, like, Corral's not Johnny Manziel. He can move around a little bit as well. Clemson losing this weekend, that was bizarre, seeing them lose to one an ACC team, but losing at NC State. They've had a weird year. They almost got beat last week by Georgia Tech. Their offense has not been very good. If they weren't Clemson, they wouldn't be in the top 25.
Right.
They barely hang on. Other local games in the area, Texas hammered Texas Tech. Would you call that a statement victory for Sarkisian and the Longhorns?
Call it running up the score in one game is what I call it.
Quarterback hurt there, too. Houston had a big second half. They roll past Navy. And you see the story from Kevon Pope? The Ohio State player that was not very happy with his playing time, was like trying to take off his uniform and stuff and like throwing his gloves into the stands, and then he tweeted afterwards, F Ohio State. Well, he's been dismissed from the Buckeyes. He's no longer with the team.
And be careful what you wish for, Chief, because you know what? If you were a five-star freshman and you weren't getting playing time and you thought like all the quarterbacks, when they don't get the starting job, you could just move on and everybody would want you. Look, it's been like three very disappointing seasons that you've played somewhat sparingly there. You ain't getting any, five universities knocking on your door. Just be happy to be there and maybe be able to call yourself a national champion and a couple of other things before you call it a career. That's not the way you handle things, and that's not the way you press anybody in the real world, the business world, or in the football world.
Alabama, Georgia, Oregon, Penn State, Iowa, the top five. Biggest mover in the AP was Arkansas. They moved up 8 spots. The bottom two movers, Clemson dropped 16 spots. The Aggies dropped 8 spots. Is there a dark horse team that has a chance to crash the college football playoff that everybody's overlooking? 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776, number to call, number to text. Coming up next, Connor Orr from Monday Morning Quarterback joins us on the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Your home for sports. ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5. Real, fun sports.